From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Talk show host Don Imus made the racist comment about the Rutgers women's basketball team on his nationally syndicated radio show. Imus in the Morning. We'll speak with Reverend Al Sharpton, who's calling for Imus to resign. And we'll also speak with the head of the National Organization for Women. Then Laura Flanders on Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians.
What happens at the margins matters. We know that on the case of the right. Why don't we believe it on the case of the left?
And we'll look at the politics of boxing legend Muhammad Ali.
I'm going to fight for the prestige, not for me, but to uplift my little brothers who are sleeping in concrete floors today in America. Black people who are living on welfare. Black people who can't eat. Black people who don't know no knowledge of themselves. Black people who don't have no future. I want to win my
time. We'll speak with sports columnist Dave Zirin about his Muhammad Ali handbook. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, hundreds of thousands of Shiites are staging a massive anti-U.S. demonstration in the holy city of Najaf to call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Shiites from around Iraq have traveled to Najaf to take part in the protest to mark the fourth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. The Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr urged Iraqis to stop cooperating with U.S. forces. This is Ali Bakr, a supporter of Sadr.
We are here today in response to the call of the commander Muqtada al-Sadr, first to demand the pullout of the occupiers from our dear country because we are living in hard circumstances. And secondly, we called on returning back sovereignty to Iraqis, especially to the true Iraqis, and that means Iraqis who did not come from outside Iraq.
In other news from Iraq, 10 more U.S. soldiers died over the weekend. 35 U.S. troops were killed in the first 8 days of April. In news from Washington, a top Democrat vowed on Sunday the Senate would not cut off funding for the war in Iraq. Carl Levin, the chair of the Senate Armed Forces Committee, made the comment on ABC's This Week.
We're not going to cut off funding for the troops. We shouldn't cut off funding for the troops. But what we should do, and we're going to do, is continue to press this president to put some pressure on the Iraqi leaders to reach a political settlement. That is what he is not doing. He said that he would insist that they meet their own benchmarks. He said that in January.
But how Levin said he disagreed with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who's backed Russ Feingold's bill that would limit war spending after March 2008. The Washington Post is reporting the United States and China managed to tone down the warnings about global warming in the new report by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. U.S. negotiators eliminated language in one section that called for cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. The final report warned human-generated warming is already making oceans more acidic and parched regions even drier. It estimated 20% to 30% of the world's species may disappear if the world keeps warming. The authors of the report also warned the risk of massive floods will increase significantly along the coast because of rising seas and more intense storms. This is Rajendra Pachauri, chair of the IPCC.
Is the poorest of the poor in the world, and this includes poor people even in prosperous societies, who are going to be the worst hit and who are the most vulnerable as far as the impacts of climate change are concerned. And I think this certainly requires attention because people who are poor are least equipped to be able to adapt to the impacts of climate change.
The environmental group Greenpeace praised the new report. This is Greenpeace spokesperson Stephanie Tunmore.
Well, we would hope that it affects the discussions at the G8. It's a very, very strong report. It paints a really apocalyptic picture of the future if we don't act very, very quickly. So we would certainly hope that it had an influence on the discussions and decisions at the G8.
In Los Angeles, tens of thousands of immigrants and immigrant rights advocates marched on Saturday in one of the nation's largest immigration protests since last May Day. Demonstrators widely criticized President Bush's proposed temporary guest worker program and the recent raids on immigrant workers. President Bush is expected to reveal a new plan today. It would create a new visa category for undocumented workers who could apply for renewable three-year work permits at a cost of $3,500. Then, in order to become legal residents, workers would have to return to their home countries, apply, and pay a $10,000 fine. The proposal also prohibits temporary workers from bringing their families into the country. Another top official at the Justice Department has resigned in the wake of the U.S. attorney scandal. Monica Goodling abruptly quit Friday afternoon as Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's liaison to the White House. Goodling has refused to testify about her role in the firing of the eight federal prosecutors. Meanwhile, criticism of Gonzalez continues to intensify. On Sunday, former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich said he should consider resigning. In news from Africa, the New York Times is reporting the Bush administration recently allowed Ethiopia to complete a secret arms purchase from North Korea in violation of international sanctions. The United States allowed the arms delivery to go through in January, shortly after Ethiopia invaded Somalia. In Afghanistan, six Canadian soldiers died Sunday in a roadside bombing. It was the worst single-day loss of life for Canadian forces since the war began. Meanwhile, the Taliban has beheaded a freelance journalist and translator who was kidnapped in Afghanistan last month. Ajmal Naqshbandi was seized along with an Italian journalist from the newspaper La Repubblica. The Italian journalist, Danielle Mastrogiacomo, was released as part of a swap for five imprisoned Taliban members. But no deal was reached to free the Afghani journalist. Last month, Ajmal pleaded for his life in a video message released by his captors.
I am a freelance journalist. We came in Helmand and we entered Taliban territory illegally. We are now with the Taliban. Until now, we are alive. And now I request the media community and the government to try their best to release us as soon as possible. Today is Monday, the 12th of March, 2007.
Ashmal's driver was also beheaded by his captors. The Taliban is still holding two French aid workers and three Afghan colleagues seized last week. More than a dozen prisoners at Guantanamo are engaged in a long-term hunger strike and are now being force-fed. In order to keep the prisoners alive, they're being strapped into restraint chairs while they're fed by plastic tubes inserted through their nostrils. One of the hunger strikers is Samuel Hajj, the Al Jazeera cameraman, who's been held at Guantanamo for nearly 5 years. Lawyers say as many as 40 prisoners are refusing to eat to protest the harsh conditions at the new maximum security section of Guantanamo, known as Camp 6. One hunger striker told his attorney, quote, "My wish is to die. We are living in a dying situation," he said. In East Timor, voters went to the polls today for the country's first presidential election since the country won its independence from Indonesia. Nobel Peace laureate José Ramos Horta is one of eight candidates running to replace Xanana Gusmão as president. In other news from the region, the Bush administration is being accused of covering up the involvement of the Indonesian military in the murder of two American citizens in 2002. The killings took place near the gold and copper mine of Freeport-McMoRan. The 15 British sailors and Marines freed last week said they were mistreated by the Iranian captors. They said they were blindfolded, interrogated, and held in isolation. The 15 were released Wednesday, one day after a kidnapped Iranian diplomat was freed in Iraq. The diplomat, Jalal Sharafi, said he was tortured and questioned by U.S. intelligence officers during his time in captivity. He said U.S. intelligence officers interrogated him about Iran's presence in Iraq. The U.S. continues to hold five Iranian officials in Iraq. Over the weekend, Iran warned it would stop cooperating with the government of Iraq if the officials are not released. In Mexico, a correspondent from the country's top television news network was shot to death in Acapulco on Friday. Amado Ramirez was attacked by two gunmen after he left his radio show. Ramirez had covered Acapulco for the Mexican network Televisa for more than a dozen years. The Miami-based Inter-American Press Association recently said Mexico has become the most dangerous place to be a journalist in the Western Hemisphere. Teachers in Argentina are going on strike today to protest the fatal shooting of a teacher by police during a protest last week. Carlos Fuente Albo, who taught chemistry, died after being hit by a tear gas canister fired at close range by police. He was taking part in a teacher-led march in the city of Neuquén, calling for better wages. Protests have been intensifying in Argentina for days. Protesters have now blocked the main roads to Neuquén, cutting off the provincial capital from the rest of the country. Here in the United States, members of the group North Carolina Stop Torture Now are heading to the offices of Arrow Contractors today to make a citizen's arrest of three executives. Arrow Contractors has been closely connected to the CIA's extraordinary rendition program and was involved in the kidnapping and torture of German citizen Khaled al-Masri. In January, German prosecutors issued arrest warrants for at least three employees of Arrow Contractors involved in the al-Masri case. On Sunday, Pope Benedict XVI decried the violence in Iraq and elsewhere during his Easter Sunday address. He spoke before thousands of worshipers in St. Peter's Square.
In Afghanistan, segnato da crescenti inquietudine e instabilità, in Medio Oriente, accanto a segni di speranza nel dialogo fra Israele e l'autorità palestinese, nulla di positivo purtroppo viene dall'Iraq.
And finally, the CEO of Ford Motor Company is being credited with literally saving President Bush's life. Alan Mulally said the president almost plugged an electrical cord into the hydrogen tank of a special Ford hybrid vehicle at the White House last week. Mulally said he violated protocol and grabbed the president's arm to prevent Bush from setting himself on fire. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Talk show host Don Imus is under fire for making racist comments on his radio broadcast. On Wednesday's edition of Imus in the Morning, Imus and his producer Bernard McKirk spoke about the Rutgers women's basketball team. Rutgers had just lost the national championship game the night before.
So I watched the basketball game last night between a little bit of Rutgers and Tennessee, the women's final.
Yeah, Tennessee won last night, seventh championship for Pat Summitt. I, man, they beat Rutgers by 13 points.
That's some rough girls from Rutgers, man. They got tattoos and
some hardcore hoes.
That's some nappy-headed hoes there, I'm going to tell you that now. Man, that's some, ooh. And the girls from Tennessee, they all look cute, you know, so like kind of like a, I don't know.
Spike Lee thing.
Yeah.
The Jingaboos versus the Wannabes, that movie that he had.
Yeah, it was a tough...
do the right thing.
I don't know if I'd have wanted to beat Rutgers or not, but they did, right?
It is a tough watch. The more I look at Rutgers, they look exactly like the Toronto Raptors.
Well, I guess, yeah.
Only tougher.
Imus in the Morning is broadcast to millions of people on more than 70 radio stations. It's based at WFAN, which is owned by CBS, and it's also broadcast on the television network MSNBC. Public condemnation intensified after Imus initially refused calls to apologize. Speaking on his radio show one day later, Imus said people shouldn't be offended by what he called, quote, some idiot comment meant to be amusing. As the controversy grew, Imus had an apparent change of heart and finally apologized Friday. Several civil rights and media groups have rejected the apology and are calling for Imus to be removed. The Rainbow Push Coalition will hold protests today outside the offices of MSNBC's parent company, NBC. The Reverend Jesse Jackson said, quote, if he has a right to use that platform to insult and degrade, then we have a moral obligation to picket NBC and to protest. The NAACP and the National Association of Black Journalists have also joined the calls for Imus's firing and a boycott of his show. Civil rights leader and founder of the National Action Network, the Reverend Al Sharpton, joins us now on the telephone. Don Imus is scheduled to appear on Reverend Sharpton's radio show today at 1 Eastern Standard Time. We are also joined by Moretta Short, who is the president of New Jersey National Organization for Women. We both welcome you to Democracy Now! Reverend Al Sharpton, what are you calling for today?
I'm calling for Imus to be fired. I think that what he said was racist and sexist, and there must be accountability. If there is anything at all to FCC regulating and protecting the public, and if there's any kind of ethics at all among advertisers, they would immediately move to have him removed. This is no borderline amusing comment. This is as racist and sexist as you can get. These are young women who have excelled academically to where they can attend Rutgers University, excelled athletically, and for them to be depicted as some nappy-headed hoes, and we act like this is something funny, I think is ridiculous. You must remember, Amy, we're not talking about just some wayward shock jock. This is a radio announcer who presidential candidates and U.S. senators and major network anchormen go on his show. This would be the mainstreaming of racism and sexism. We cannot tolerate that.
So what are you exactly calling for? I mean, Imus is broadcast in many places here. He's broadcast on WFAN here in New York, owned by CBS. It goes out syndicated around the country. And then MSNBC every morning broadcasts the show on television.
They should immediately terminate Imus. There's enough in their contracts on moral clause alone to get out of these contracts. He has tried to meet. I said I would not meet with him. If he wanted to talk, he had to talk in public. He said, come on my show. I said, I would never try to get listeners to your show. He said, I'll come to yours. I intend to tell him today what I've told everybody for the last 3 or 4 days. He ought to be fired. If he thinks he's a good guy, as he's saying, and he was misunderstood, then he ought to say that, and I will say that. If you're a good guy, you'll resign and help to keep a precedent that this cannot be tolerated in America. This is not personal. What he did was racist and sexist and should not be given a pass because he's commercially successful.
Have you spoken with any of the executives of CBS or NBC?
Spoke to the people at NBC, and we intend to speak to the people at CBS. We intend to be having demonstrations in New York in front of CBS and NBC if he is still there at the end of this week. And National Action Network and National Association of Black Journalists and all of us who began this together are reaching out to other groups to join us in this. And I will again make it clear when Mr. Imus, if he were to show up at the radio show today, that this is not about whether he's a good guy or whether he does charitable work. This is about accountability in media. If the airwaves can be used to in any way mainstream racism and sexism, it is an affront to all of us. We must resist it. We cannot have a precedent where people can say these kinds of things and walk away without any penalty.
And your response to Don Imus basically saying he's a good person who made a bad comment, that he just made an idiotic statement?
You can go to any criminal court building today. People that are charged with crimes say that every day. The problem is the crime, not the person. I don't have to give a long list of why I think Imus is a good or bad person, even though he has said many offensive things before. I think this act must be punished. The issue is not his other activities. The issue is he said it. He clearly said it. You played the tape. Others have heard the tape. And whether or not FCC that regulates media in this country and advertisers are going to continue to support and allow this kind of language to be used. That's the issue here. The issue here is not whether he's a good guy or bad guy. If he was a good guy, he would say, I did something wrong. I want to step up and withdraw and help establish and continue the establishment of a precedent here that racism has no part in the airways. Al Campanis, who was vice president of the Dodgers, said something that I think was even less offensive than Imus, and he had to leave the Dodgers. Jimmy the Greek, there's a precedent here that we are now trying to act like in the 21st century that racist language, racist kind of commentary can be justified as humor and excused because the guy saying it is an all right guy. I don't think we can live by that kind of precedent.
The NABJ, Brian Monroe, who's the president of the National Association of Black Journalists, also calling for IMIS to be kicked out, raised other quotes calling Gwen Ifill, his words were, a cleaning lady, and describing William Roden of the New York Times as a quota hire. Those were quotes in an NABJ press release that IMIS had made earlier at other times.
Yeah, IMIS has a record of this from what he said about Gwen Ifill, what he said about Roden, what he said about others. But I don't think that anything has crossed the line more blatantly than what he said about these young ladies. And again, both sexist and racist. And are we just going to continue with this and act like it's all right or okay, I can get away with just an apology? I mean, Michael Richards, who just caused the firestorm with his night comeback, was one matter. And I felt there that was totally wrong. I've condemned people in the black community for using the N-word and being offensive. And many of them were fired and suspended from radio jobs. Why would we take a different stand when it comes to Don Imus? Because he deals with the political elite. I think that's nonsense. I think he must be penalized. I think the precedent in media in this country is more important than the person of Don Imus or anyone else in terms of their careers.
Are you taking this to the FCC as well?
We have this morning sent a letter to the FCC asking for them to take action, and we want to meet with the commissioners of the FCC. If the FCC cannot say to stations that this is not allowed, then what is their role as regulators? Are they saying to taxpayers that it's all right that racist, sexist remarks go out over the airwaves? That is not part of our regulation. That's not a question now of free speech. This is a question of where we regulate radio and regulate TV differently for different people. There are any number of DJs around the country, even blacks, that have been fired and suspended for saying things far less offensive but offensive. And I have supported that, even friends of mine, because I think that you cannot allow the airwaves to become the toilet of racist language in America.
The Reverend Al Sharpton joining us on the phone from New York. He is going to be having Don Imus on his radio program at 1 Eastern Standard Time. Moretta Short also with us, president of National Organization for Women New Jersey. Moretta Short, what is NOW calling for?
Well, thank you, Amy. Yes, well, right now we're asking for people to go to our website and take action by sending messages to General Manager Chuck Bortnick of radio station WFAN, which produces Imus's show, and to Karen Mateo, Communications Vice President of CBS Radio, which owns WFAN, and to MSNBC Television, which airs and promotes the show. Imus's message is racist to the core, is sexist to the core, and is totally unacceptable. Now, and our webpage is now.org, by the way. And on Wednesday at 2:30, there is going to be a protest and rally at Rutgers University at 350 Martin Luther King Boulevard. So those who are asking, what is Al doing about it? What is NOW doing about it? What is NAACP doing about it? You have work to do. You are NOW. You are the NAACP, and it's time for us to move on this. Imus's actions are totally unacceptable.
Moretta Short, you are in New Jersey. Have you spoken to people at Rutgers?
Well, right now I'm waiting for callbacks. I have put out calls last night, and I'm waiting for the calls to be returned. Right now I'm reaching out to some members of the Rutgers basketball team. I have not spoken to any of them as of yet, but I certainly am looking forward to it.
And has NOW met with General Electric, which owns NBC, or NBC officials, or MSNBC, or WFAN, or CBS, which owns FAN?
Yeah, that is a very good question. And I want to get to that later, but I think that it's important to say about these apologies that Imus is supposed to make. There's certain things you can't apologize for, Amy. You can apologize for stepping on somebody's toe, bumping into them, but you cannot apologize for the filth that has come out of his mouth. I mean, I think it's utterly disgusting, and it targets a certain audience that nobody's focusing on, the white male, beer-drinking, 18 to 38. Is what makes them feel it's okay to do that. So now his show is creating an audience that thinks that talking in that way and insulting people and spewing out that hatred is acceptable. It is totally unacceptable.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll certainly report on what happens today, the latest developments, what Dynamis says on Reverend Al Sharpton's radio show, and what the plans of the corporate networks are in dealing with Imus in the morning.
Okay. Well, Amy, thank you very much. And I just want to say that this is coming to us on the 35th year of the anniversary of Title IX, when women have been given the equal opportunities in education, including sports, whereas years ago we just did not have that sort of thing. And by the way, it was introduced by a woman of color, Patsy Mink of Hawaii. And I think that's a very important point to bring out as well.
Thank you very much.
We certainly support the rally at Rutgers, and we'll be doing rallies at CBS and NBC on Friday and Saturday of this week, and we'll keep you informed, Amy.
Thanks very much, Reverend Al Sharpton and Moretta Short, the president of New Jersey Now. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Laura Flanders, who's written a book called Blue Grit, and then the sports writer Dave Zirin, who's written a lot about Title IX. Today we'll be talking to him about Muhammad Ali and also about a man behind bars in Angola in the prison in Louisiana. Stay with us.
Say it loud. I'm coming around. Say it loud. I'm coming around. Yeah. Some people say we got a lot of malice. Some say it's a lot of nerve. But I say we won't quit moving until we get what we deserve. We've been built and we've been scorned. We've been treated bad, talked about as sure as you born. Just as sure as it takes two eyes to make a pair. Brother, we can't quit until we get our share. Say it loud. Say it loud. One more time. Say it loud. I've worked on jobs with my feet in my hand. You know all the work I did was for the other man. But now we demand a chance to do things for ourselves. We're tired of beating our head against the wall and working with someone else. Say it loud. 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 Ow! Ooh-wee.
Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. James Brown. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The big news from Washington, D.C. this week, money for elections, money for war. Democratic presidential hopeful Senator Barack Obama announced he raised over $25 million in the first 3 months of the year. Totals just shy of Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's record amount. Campaign records show Obama received more individual donations than Clinton and John Edwards combined. The 2008 election is expected to be the most expensive presidential campaign ever. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, a key Democratic leader has given new indications Democrats are prepared to back down on their call to cut off war funding if President Bush vetoes a bill calling for a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Speaking on ABC Sunday, Armed Services Committee Chair Senator Carl Levin said, quote, "We're not going to vote to cut funding, period." Levin said a veto would lead Democrats to consider removing language calling for the withdrawal of troops. Are Democrats fulfilling their elected mandate, or are they ignoring the grassroots movements that helped sweep them to office? That's one question raised in a new book by radio host and author Laura Flanders. The book is called Blue Grit: True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Laura is the host of Radio Nation on the National Air America Radio Network. Her previous books include Bush Women, How They Won the White House for Their Man, and The W Effect, Sexual Politics in the Bush Years and Beyond. Laura Flanders joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Laura.
It's great to be here, Amy.
What is blue grit?
Blue grit, you know, grit, that's the stuff that gets you through, the metal that enables you to take on tough stuff. It's also the stuff that gets in your shoe and blisters your toe. Blue gritters, the folks I'm talking about, do both of those things for the Democratic Party. They discomfort the establishment, and I think they bring the passion to the issues that won the election last year.
And how do you fit blue grit into this last vote? The vote for timetable, but for continued funding for war.
Well, I think the fact that the Democratic leadership is talking about timetables at all is a victory for the blue grit Democrats out there. And Democrats in my book are those that call themselves capital D Democrats and a lot of other people besides. The reason I think that this is a moment of a kind of blue grit tide rising is because you do have a Democratic leadership that have been dragged kicking and screaming to this position, now having to acknowledge that their position in power is attributable to the forces at their base. And that's what I document in the book that I think's really been happening really since 2004.
You also have just written a piece for Alternate, talking about to beat the right, Clinton and Obama need to be clear about supporting gay rights.
Well, there's been a big trend in the left and the center to say the way for the Democrats to win next time is to not get snookered by marriage equality and abortion rights. I say the Democrats in denial, their denial is what loses them. Let's face it. I mean, the right doesn't need any more ammunition against Hillary Clinton. What she needs to do, she's one of the contenders, is to warm her support on the left. The Democratic leadership is never going to be anti-gay, anti-abortion, anti-racial equality enough to be able to persuade their opponents that they're on the same side or they're not a threat. But in constantly running away from their base, who, you know, whether they like it or not, are gays and lesbians, women who support abortion, people of color. They may not like it, but that's the base they've got, and that's the base they depend on every time it comes to an election.
We were just talking about Don Imus, referring to Rutgers athletes, women on the basketball team as nappy-haired hoes, and this demand for his resignation. You refer in your piece to Ann Coulter speaking before the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., referring to John Edwards as a faggot. Talk more about that.
Well, we've seen it before. The right will raise a trial balloon, and if it's not shot down fast, it carries on. Remember Arnold Schwarzenegger talking about girly men? He used that first against the Democrats in the California Assembly. The next thing we know, he's using the word about all Democrats from the stage of the Republican National Convention. I don't believe that trial balloon from Coulter has burst yet. And I think that it's the lesson of the gay and lesbian rights movement and other movements of grassroots folks who, let's face it, were the first people to be swift boated in this country. It wasn't John Kerry. Remember the welfare queen. The communities we're talking about are the people who've learned about how to tackle and respond to the right. And they know being nice to a bully doesn't work. You've got to fight back. You've got to stand up. And that's what these candidates have got to learn.
And what does Peter Pace, the general's comments about homosexuality, have to do with the Democrats? What do you think of the Democrats'
response? When Hillary Clinton was
it?
Asked what she thought about that, she said she would leave it for other people to decide. That is no kind of a response. You've got to stand up for what's right, and it'll serve your interests. Ask somebody like the people I profile in the book. Lupe Valdez, the sheriff of Dallas, no lefty community. Dallas elected its first Latina, its first woman sheriff, its first out lesbian, and its first Democrat in 20 years when they elected a woman who had the chutzpah to stand up and say that she had respect for herself, she wanted other people to respect her too, she was an agent of change, and she was going to serve the people as the sheriff. She's there doing the work and being exactly what she said she would be.
Laura Flanders, you talk about the right being a much better model for mobilizing grassroots.
Well, you know, it's not just the left that has grassroots, and sometimes we forget that. In the cover story that I have in The Nation magazine about what happened in Montana, I say, isn't it interesting? There's a kind of leper versus lover relationship to people at marginal groups. On the right, they have this lover approach. They seduce, they flirt, they kiss the ring of the people at their margins, make them promises, invite them for dinner, take them out on dates. The Democratic Party treat those at their margins as lepers if they acknowledge at all that they exist. And yet look at a state like Montana. There are lessons to learn there about victories for Democrats across the West and for progressive issues across the West, but not if you only look at the candidates. You need to look at the grassroots movements that brought the governor's victory in 2004, flipped the House and the Senate, and brought about John Tester's victory in the Senate last year.
Talk more about Montana as an example.
Well, you know, one of the problems with horse race coverage, and we talk about the media covering campaigns as if they were horse races. The problem with that, as many people say, is it makes it look as if the horses on the track are the only people that matter. What about all those people in the stands? This book, Blue Grit, is to direct attention back up to the stands. And looking at Montana, you realize, yeah, there are lessons to learn, but not if they stop and start with the candidate. What you had there was a coalition of organizations, of environmentalists, women's groups, Native Americans, who expanded the electorate, who worked their networks, and a state Democratic Party that built relationships with those groups. It's no news to Brian Schweitzer and John Tester that their victory wasn't built by, you know, a single hero alone. But for those of us on the outside, we're often led to see just the candidate, just the miracle. They talked about the Montana miracle and not, as it were, the nine months and mom. You know, you're seeing the beaming baby and not what went into it. We study the right, don't we? We're great at drawing those spidery maps of the relationships that bring issues from the margins of the right to the center. And yet somehow we haven't done that work on the left. But power builds in the same way on the left-hand side of the spectrum as it does on the right, which is from the bottom up.
Talk about Nevada.
Nevada. That'll be the big test of the Democratic candidates, whether they can say it right. And so far, they're doing a good job. Here you have a state where John Kerry in 2004 narrowly lost, a battleground state where a lot of resources were poured in. A lot of outside activists flew in from California to walk those streets, to register voters, to try and turn people out. What you also had was an indigenous progressive movement that had been around for many years. And one of the lead groups I talk about is PLAN, the Progressive Leadership Alliance of Nevada, in Reno, in the South. It was based in the labor movement, in the culinary workers, in the SCIU, in the AFL. What you had was a difference of tactic. The people flown in were getting to know the place for the first time. The people based there were working on issues that they knew would move people, issues of immigration rights, issues of raising the minimum wage. And on the minimum wage, they passed a ballot initiative raising the minimum wage by a dollar and then keeping in track with inflation. In every county, in every precinct, in every part of that state, rich, poor, rural, urban, conservative, liberal, how did they do that? It was clearly a popular issue. And yet half of those people who voted for it also voted for Bush, I believe, because the presidential candidates failed to bind themselves to the issue, to speak the language that the Nevadans were speaking, and to understand that that was what was hot on the ground, and that was what they needed to get up real close to. They would have won.
Utah is called the reddest state in the nation. You even question red, blue.
I do question red, blue. I think the diagnosis of this country as two warring factions, red versus blue, is problematic. You get down to the county level and you realize that the person that wins, the victor is the person that claims a narrow margin of victory. Most of those county level maps are very purple. What makes the difference is who has passion on the ground, who has the foot soldiers who are going to go that extra step to get people to the polls. Utah, yeah, the reddest state of the union, until very recently still giving George Bush pretty much his only thumbs up approval ratings. Now, interestingly, even Mormons polled are against the war in Iraq. But Utah is a fascinating state where for two terms, the largest city in the reddest state has elected one of the most progressive mayors in the country. Rocky Anderson, a man who's pro-marriage equality, pro-environmental protection, signed his city onto the Kyoto Protocols, and they're meeting the goals way years in advance. A man who managed to work with the Mormon Church, the LDS Church, work with the ACLU, where he came from, and bring a community together around, among other issues, environmental protection. Utah, the big ski capital of the Western Rockies, they know that if their snow melts, they're in trouble. They've brought people together to make a difference, and they show why cities are important. And raises another question. Cities are the heart, are the beating, vibrant heart of the Democratic base. Why, then, do they receive so little attention and so little kind of such a low profile in the Democratic races? I think they're a place of hope, but they're a place in trouble. Look at New Orleans, look at Miami. We need to shore cities up and address city issues, but typically Democratic candidates have focused on rural issues and rural states, and that's because they're voting, that they're chasing after those undecided votes.
Laura Flanders, what about Mississippi, New Orleans, Florida?
Well, you know, one of the exciting things that we've seen recently in Florida is a governor decide to reenfranchise felons. Now, that comes after years of work by grassroots groups. Another question, why was it a Republican governor who realized that he could free up hundreds of thousands of potential voters simply with the movement of a pen across a page? Democratic governors, Mark Warner in Virginia, had the opportunity to reenfranchise felons. Those are largely Democratic voters, and yet he chose not to. That would have been 300,000, people estimate, 300,000 more likely Democratic voters. But from what we can see, he didn't want to get that close to felons, to African-Americans, to people who are scapegoated in the press. So what's interesting about Florida is grassroots groups have managed to make the issue of voting reform and voting rights a hot-button issue in the state. And it hasn't been partisan. It's been Republicans and Democrats working together. We've covered it a lot in our program. With respect to New Orleans, it comes up in the book. I've been there several times, as I know have you. It's the big story to me that raises another question. I guess the book is full of them, about the media. We like to blame often our problems on the failure of media to cover a situation. What we saw post-Katrina, post the breaking of the levees in New Orleans, was all the media in the world, but still no policy agenda that responded to what we saw there. No policy proposals coming from Washington to talk about how do we rebuild the social safety net around our cities and our states. I think that's because you can have the media, but if you don't have the movements, you don't have the power to change the agenda. So in the book I sort of say, you know, we actually have a lot of progressive media. Do we have the Wall Street Journal? Do we have Fox News? Not quite. But we can't simply blame the lack of media coverage. We have to also look at the need to build movements that will demand real change in the way that the right laid out an agenda, worked for it, built from the grassroots up, and over 30 years came an awfully close distance to where they wanted to get.
Do you think that it's appropriate to raise the issue of Mary Cheney about to have a baby? Apparently, the vice president just announced that the baby that she will have in a month will be a grandson. He's very much looking forward to his grandson, he said. But when he was questioned about it before, he said it was totally inappropriate to raise this issue.
Well, I think John Edwards, during the debates in 2004, was clumsy when he, instead of just standing up for what was right, kind of played gotcha with the vice president about having a gay daughter. That's not the point. We're talking about human equality. What's so problematic, for example, when Hillary Clinton was asked what she thought about Peter Pace's comments, what would have been so difficult about saying, you want to talk morality, Chief of Staff? You know, you want to talk morality, let's talk torture. Human equality is promised under the U.S. Constitution. What is the 14th Amendment about? We as a society can no longer afford to discriminate against people on the basis of who they love. It's wrong. It hurts me. It hurts our community. It's not about, ooh, you've got a gay daughter. Ooh, you're going to have the grandson of a gay couple. I think we can get bigger than that. And frankly, people are getting bigger than that. Deval Patrick, in the governor of Massachusetts, every Massachusetts legislator that took a position for gay marriage, marriage equality, was reelected. You've got people all over the state who are finding this isn't a losing issue. The legislature of Idaho just threw out, Indiana just threw out an anti-gay marriage constitutional amendment. Idaho rejected it, too. Arizona, in the last election, the first state to vote down an initiative. You look at the grand scheme of American history, you know, like Dr. King said, the arc tends towards justice. And on these very issues that we're told are the hot-button social issues, don't go near them at the cost of your life, we're winning. Look how far we've come on female equality, on gay and lesbian equality. We have 66% of people saying they believe in and approve some legal recognition for domestic partners. That's a huge distance. These are not losers, not if you stand up with authenticity. And frankly, as John Edwards did this recently, say that he believes that this is right and that what Peter Pace and others say is wrong. It's as simple as that. Look like you believe it. Talk about your real honest beliefs. And I think people respond to that. Paul Wellstone found it was true.
Laura Flanders, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Laura is beginning her national tour. She's going to be going around the country in New York tomorrow night. 92nd Street Y, going on to Washington, D.C., then Seattle, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Denver, back in New York. You can go to her website, lauraflanders.com. Her new book is Blue Grit: True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. Public Enemy here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. We end today with a new look at the boxing legend Muhammad Ali. Ali is considered the greatest boxer in the history of sports. In his prime, he was an outspoken advocate of the Black Muslim movement, a critic of the Vietnam War. He was sentenced to prison and stripped of his heavyweight title for refusing to fight in Vietnam.
Cassius Clay, at a federal court in Houston, is found guilty of violating the U.S. Selective Service laws by refusing to be inducted. He is sentenced to 5 years in prison and fined $10,000.
An excerpt that came from the documentary When They Were Kings. Sports columnist Dave Zirin has written the book, The Muhammad Ali Handbook. It's a new account of Ali's career and his groundbreaking political involvement. Dave writes the weekly column Edge of Sports and is a regular contributor to The Nation magazine, joining us here in a Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be here, Amy.
Before we talk about Muhammad Ali, I want to go back to the top story today, Don Imus's comments disparaging the Rutgers basketball team. And Moretta Short of Now talking about this being the 35th anniversary of Title IX. Can you talk more about this? Because this is something you've written extensively about.
Absolutely. When Title IX was first put into play back in the early 1970s, roughly one out of 29 girls in middle school, junior high school played sports. Today, that number is roughly one out of three. And so statistics show that young girls who play sports at an early age are actually less likely to end up in abusive relationships, less likely to have eating disorders, less likely to have issues with drugs and alcohol. So you're talking about legislation, a direct result of the women's movement of the late 60s and early 70s, that has benefited the lives of tens of millions of women in this country. And the fact that it's something that both George W. Bush and Chief Justice John Roberts have both said that they oppose, I think is something that we all should be very aware of on this anniversary of this incredible legislation.
And your thoughts on Don Imus, whether he should be fired?
Oh, I think he should be canned like a tuna. I mean, I think I speak for a lot of people when I say I'm just so sick and tired of the shock jocks, of the Coulters, of the Imuses, being able to say whatever they want to say and then reaping the publicity from that and then being able to just apologize and go on with a slight bump in their ratings. But I'll tell you something that's bothersome to me, and this is why I wrote the Muhammad Ali handbook, is the silence from the world of sports. I mean, with all due respects to Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson, I wanted to hear the rise of voices from NBA players, from NBA players, from NBA Commissioner David Stern, from all the people who are offended by what Imus said. The sports world needs to have its own progressive milieu to respond to things like this. I mean, look how political the world of sports is. Everything from Pat Tillman to gay athletes to this issue. I mean, it's so infused with politics, yet too often politics is verboten for athletes. I've spoken in the last week to NBA and WNBA players who were repulsed by what Don Imus said. But the idea of speaking out is such a foreign concept that it makes Ali's history all the more relevant for today. The athlete who would not be silenced.
Let's talk about Muhammad Ali and what he would say out loud.
What Ali would say out loud would be, he certainly would say, I think I have a quarrel with Don Imus. I mean, he would say, I ain't got no quarrel with the sisters at Rutgers University. I mean, that's the thing about Muhammad Ali in the 1960s that's so incredible. I mean, he finished in the bottom 1% of his high school class. He barely graduated from high school. Yet on all the important social issues of the day, on the edge of the black freedom struggle, on the Vietnam War, while the best and the brightest were talking about all deliberate speed for integration and talking about war in Vietnam, Muhammad Ali knew which side he was on time and again. He knew there was right and he knew there was wrong. And because he had that direct connection both to a black political tradition that was anti-war through people like Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, Marcus Garvey, and also because, you know, his own family came from the black working class in the South, he knew which side he was on a series of these questions when the leading edge of politics of the so-called experts were so patently wrong.
I wanted to play another clip highlighting Muhammad Ali's political beliefs. This a clip from When We Were Kings, the documentary about Ali's 1974 championship bout with George Foreman in Kinshasa that came to be known as the Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah, I'm in Africa. Yeah, Africa's my home. Damn America and what America thinks. Yeah, I live in America, but Africa's the home of the black man, and I was a slave 400 years ago, and I'm going back home to fight among my brothers. Yeah.
That was Muhammad Ali speaking in 1974.
Absolutely. And, you know, going back to that Kinshasa fight, I think it's a great example of the redemptive power of Muhammad Ali, because by that time he was somebody who, you know, had returned to the world of boxing, had fought off through the Supreme Court a 5-year prison sentence given down to him by the federal courts, an outrageously high sentence for a draft resister of the time. And by the end, after that fight, he was named Sportsman of the Year by Sports Illustrated. So he makes this amazing journey from being the most vilified, hated athlete in the history of the United States, and I don't think there's any contention about that, to becoming a figure of reconciliation who was invited by Gerald Ford to the White House to shake hands. And that's the thing about Ali, is that he was always bound up in the rhythms of the social movements of the day. So in the 60s, he becomes a figure that's beloved by the anti-war movement and the black freedom struggle, hated by the mainstream. Yet as the movements died in the 70s, he became a figure of bringing those two worlds back together.
This is another clip of Muhammad Ali, again from When We Were Kings, also before the fight with George Foreman.
I'm going to fight for the prestige, not for me, but to uplift my little brothers who are sleeping in concrete floors today in America. Black people who are living on welfare. Black people who can't eat. Black people who don't know no knowledge of themselves. Black people who don't have no future. I want to win my title and walk down the alleys, sit on the garbage can with the wine heads. I want to walk down the street with the dope addicts, talk to the prostitutes, so I can help a lot of people. I can show them films. I can take this documentary. I can take movies and help uplift my people in Louisville, Kentucky, Indianapolis, Indiana, Cincinnati, Ohio. I can go through the sea in Florida, Mississippi, and show the little black Africans in them countries who didn't know this was their country.
That's right.
You look like people in Mississippi, in Alabama, and Georgia. They're your brothers.
That's right.
But they never knew you was over here, and you don't know much about them. God is blessing me through this accident, through boxing, to help get to all these people and to show them films that I haven't seen. I know they haven't seen them. I'm whirling. I haven't seen them.
That's right.
Now I can go get all these films. You governments can let me take pictures. You can let me do things, and I can take all this back to America. But it's good to be a winner. All I got to do is look George Foreman.
That's right. That was Muhammad Ali right before the fight with George Foreman, 1974.
Yeah, and what I can't help thinking about hearing this is about how distanced a lot of the star athletes are today from that kind of mindset of saying, I'm fighting for the people in the for the winos, for the dope heads, for the people who live in the gutter, for the people who are told that they can never amount to anything. You know, LeBron James, who's the most famous player in the National Basketball Association, still only 22 years old, was asked in an interview about his career aspirations, and he said at the same time that he wanted to be a global icon like Muhammad Ali, and that he wanted to be the first athlete billionaire. Now, if you actually know the history, those two ideas are so in conflict with one another. Yet, because all LeBron James knows is that Muhammad Ali is famous for being famous. That's what LeBron James knows, and because few people have had their political teeth extracted like Muhammad Ali. I mean, he's been the victim of a political root canal. So the hope for this book is to try to restore the teeth to what Muhammad Ali actually stood for in the 60s.
I wanted to ask you about Gary Tyler.
Yes.
We did a broadcast with the New York Times columnist Bob Herbert talking about his case. Explain how you're organizing with athletes.
Yes. I mean, first of all...
And explain his case quickly.
Absolutely. Gary Tyler, he's been in Angola prison, a former slave plantation for 32 years. The case against him is spotty, to put it mildly. I believe he's innocent looking at the evidence in the case. Bob Herbert believes he's innocent looking at the evidence of the case. And I read Bob Herbert's three columns published over the course of a month in the New York Times, and I heard him on your show, Amy. And when I heard this, I tried to ask myself, well, what can I do to help? I mean, it was so stark and so upsetting, Gary Tyler's story. So, you know, my little corner of the world is the intersection of athletes and politics. So I put out a call. I wrote a letter calling it Jocks for Justice, sent it out to some athletes, and I wanted to see who would be willing to sign on and if we could get some publicity by doing a public statement. And I got to tell you, one of the things that was really shocking about it is usually getting in touch with former athletes, with famous athletes, it's like trying to get in touch with Don Corleone, like you have to talk to the guy who knows the guy who knows the guy just to talk to somebody. And it was so striking to me how people just got back to me so quickly. The older athletes, people like Reuben Hurricane Carter, Tommy Smith, and John Carlos, former Yankees pitcher Jim Boughton and Red Sox all-star Bill Spaceman Lee. They remembered Gary's case from the early 70s, and immediately they got back to me, signed me on. Some of the younger athletes, people like Etan Thomas for the Washington Wizards, or Toni Smith, the woman basketball player who made her stand protesting the war at Manhattanville College. They, like me, needed to be educated on the case because it has been so forgotten over the last 30 years. But when they heard about it, I mean, it was just like it has that feel of a movement right now. And they were on board.
And just again, for those who didn't hear our broadcast of the case of Gary Tyler. Gary Tyler is a man who's been in prison now since he was 16 years old, his case being called one of the great miscarriages of justice in modern history in the United States. He's the African-American jailed in 1974 for a murder many believe he didn't commit, an all-white jury convicting him based entirely on the statement of four witnesses who have later recanted their testimony. I want to thank you very much, Dave Zirin, for joining us. The new book is called Muhammad Ali Handbook. Howard Zinn has called Dave Zirin a talented sports writer with a social conscience. That does it for our broadcast. podcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrufo Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Presser, Matei Jen-Yutz, Mike DiFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Thanks also to Angela Alston, Andrew Quinn, Rebecca Silver, Luai, Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Becca Staley, and Nicole Salazar. On April 16th, I'll be in Boston on Patriots Day with Howard Zinn at Faneuil Hall on Patriots Day as we talk about the importance of independent media in a time of war. You can go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.